Welcome to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast, where we explore the diverse and interconnected realities of the medieval world. I'm one of the series producers, Logan Quigley, and in today's special episode, we're going to pull back the curtain to talk about some of the things that go into making this podcast. We'll reflect on the podcast's mission, where we've been the past three seasons, and where we're headed next. Everybody here today is also a producer of the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. Let's start by getting some introductions out of the way. So as we go around, go ahead and give us a sense of who you are and what the first text or object was that got you into medieval studies or the medieval world. John, do you want to start us off?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jonathan John Correa Reyes, and I'm an assistant professor of English at Clemson University. My way into the Middle Ages. Thinking back, I think, somewhat surprisingly, some might say, that my interest in the medieval world has much to do with growing up in Latin America. From a young age, I was already fascinated by stories typically classified as magical realism. I'm thinking Gabriel García Márquez, Cien Años de Soledad, the short stories of Jorge Luis Borges, so on and so forth. The combination of realism with philosophical and fantastical elements always worked for me. Imagine my surprise when, during my undergraduate studies in the University of Puerto Rico, I encountered medieval texts in my classes and noticed that they also seemed to blend reality with fantasy and philosophy. Reading Arthurian romances, Beowulf, La Chanson de Roland, Cantar de Mia Cid, and eventually the Icelandic sagas, I realized that I had quite a few things to say.
That's awesome. Reed, what about you?
Oh, well, there's a lot of different ways, I think, that got me to the Middle Ages. But to introduce myself, my name is Reed O'Mara. I'm currently a PhD student at Case Western Reserve University in the Department of Art History and Art. And it was interesting because the question that we got was about, you know, what was the first text that got you into the medieval world? And then I think somebody nicely added object for me. Because I'm an art historian, but somewhat ironically, I actually got into the Middle Ages through a text. So unfortunate, terrible art historian. In my undergraduate career at the University of Alabama, I was actually a German major, along with economics, which, you know, didn't really work out, but also a German major. And I actually studied Das Nibelungenlied, or the Song of the Nibelungs, pretty early on. And I loved it. And I was like, this is great. This like whole epic saga of Siegfried and his wife, Kriemhild, and all of this. And I loved it. And it wasn't until I was actually abroad in Germany that a professor pointed out to me that you could actually just study art history of the Middle Ages, which she came to this conclusion for me after I had seen all of these churches and medieval sites and just was aghast every time. And she was like, you know, you can just do this, right? And I was like, wait, really? So I really got into it through the literature and then through the architecture. And now I'm a manuscripts person. So how about that?
Woohoo. Will, what's your story?
Hello there, I'm Will Beatty, and I suppose my route into the Middle Ages, I'm going to go ahead and give three different texts and be cheeky. The first two, though, were really medievalism. I think when I was younger, I got really interested in medieval fantasy fiction, writing by people like Raymond E. Feist. I remember reading Magician when I was quite young, and I think that was probably one of my first gateways into the sword and sorcery kind of side of medievalism. And then also the poem The Lady of Shalott by Tennyson, which I think is 1830s. Very Arthurian, again, very high fantasy. But at university at St. Andrews, I did a first year course, which was kind of an introduction to English literature. And the first thing we did was the Old English poem, The Dream of the Rood. And I just immediately fell in love with the language, the poetry of Old English. And that was my first opportunity to actually study an Old English text in its original language. And I think from there, I quickly realized that Old English was definitely my thing. So that's what I've been doing ever since.
Lauren, what's your story?
Oh, hi, everybody. So I'm really excited to be here. I previously appeared with Reed on the Medieval Stat.net episode that we released back in December of 2024. before. But yeah, I'm a new producer on the podcast, which I'm thrilled about. I am a PhD candidate of French at the University of Virginia. And what got me into the Middle Ages? I got more into the Middle Ages much later in my academic careers than I think a lot of students maybe tend to do. But when I first discovered medieval texts, I felt like they were so foreign and yet so familiar that I just needed to go deeper and deeper. And one of the first texts that I really remember enjoying in a complex way was the Cent Ballades d'Amants et de Dames, the 100 Ballads of the Lover and the Lady by Christine de Pizan. And that text also weirdly is what got me into doing digital humanities research. I'm a digital humanities fellow at the University of Virginia. And when I was reading this text, I was just really interested in thinking about the way that these 100 poems are structured together and how specifically I traced her use of word choice when creating this image of grafting two trees together, the Lord and the Lady being these sort of trees coming together. And I did this sort of digital humanities project by hand, which was laborious and not great, but I was basically doing like a sort of quantitative analysis, but totally manually. And by the time I finished that project, my professor for that class, Deborah McGrady, she sort of encouraged me to think, you know, there's other ways of doing this. You can do these sort of like quantitative analysis, and there's something called digital humanities, and there's actually like ways of doing it not by hand that you could learn more about. So really, it was the Middle Ages that brought me more into studying digital methods, which is a really nice tie-in. But I think what has kept me in the Middle Ages in terms of being my field of study is just the people. I mean, the people on this podcast, certainly, but the people I've met in the field are so welcoming. And I feel like we particularly have an academic field where we share our material, where we're excited about what each other is doing. And I just felt very welcomed in that way and made me want to go deeper. So thank you for welcoming me here.
Of course.
Logan, I think it's your turn.
Who are you?
I'm Logan Quigley. I got my PhD from Notre Dame in medieval literature. And the thing that got me into the Middle Ages definitely had something to do with being a big fan of Lord of the Rings ever since I was a child. But I remember being in my sophomore year at Purdue University, and I was taking a Vikings class led by Professor Sean Hughes. And I remember loving that class and just having this realization that he did it for his job. Like, he was getting paid to do this all the time. And that was my first realization that I could go deeper into learning about these sorts of things. And then it was that, and I think coupled with Arthuriana, because we all grew up knowing the myths of King Arthur. And I always found myself wondering, where did this start? That was just a question I always had. And I think I was starting my senior year at Purdue, and I had this realization that I could kind of try to answer that question. Not as in it hadn't been answered before, but it was the first time I realized, oh, there are people who talk about this and who have written books about where stories of King Arthur come from and things. And I got a book from this dusty bookstore that I loved at Purdue and tried to read it and couldn't really get much into it. But that, I think, kind of sparked my interest in going a little deeper into some of these questions. So I think we should progress to talking about how we know each other. And that's a good way also into conversations about like what this podcast is about. Why did it start? We all know each other because we were part of the GSC, the Medieval Academy of America's Graduate Student Committee. Lauren, as someone who's currently on the GSC, what is the GSC?
My understanding of what the GSC is has been fundamentally shaped by the other members of this podcast who came before me on the GSC. The mission of the Graduate Student Committee of the MAA is to offer programming and points of connection for graduate students across the medieval studies field in different institutions, beyond North America as well, certainly. So we have a group of 6, sometimes 7 graduate students on this committee that rotate out, and we work together to put on events of interest to students and to also advocate for the needs of graduate students within the academy. So one example that came up in the time that Will and I were both on the committee was we were contacted by some graduate students who wanted to reform the way that travel bursaries were handled, for example, for the MAA. And we, the committee, were then able to take that request and submit it to the council and then change the way travel bursaries are done forever in perpetuity, at least until someone else complains. So there's these small but meaningful ways in which we advocate for graduate students, primarily in terms of creating network opportunities at conferences. We offer professionalization webinars all the time. You guys have a deeper sense of the lore than I do. I'm currently on there, but these guys came before me. I'm the current chair, but prior to me, Will was chair, and then prior to Will, Reed was chair, and then prior to Reed, John was chair. Is that correct?
That is correct. I was happily in the same cohort as Logan. To speak about the connection between this podcast and the GSC, I will start by saying that I don't think this podcast as it exists could have emerged from any other place. Throughout my experience in the GSC, first as a member and eventually as chair, it never felt like a top-down power hierarchy. It always felt like a horizontal comradeship. And this is something I am grateful for, and it is something that was bequeathed to us by previous GSC committees under the sage leadership of Christine Bachman, Jill Bierke, and my personal friend and mentor, Ted Chalice. And we try to recreate this positive environment in the podcast. As listeners will have noticed, when we intervene in the episodes, it's for the most part in a supportive role, as interviewers or behind the scenes, handling the audio editing and such. This is very deliberate. From the beginning, we intended for this podcast to be a forum that we could lend out, thinking about the requests and concerns we received in our time in the GSC from our global community of graduate students, concerns related to the state of the academic job market and requests for programming that offered guidance in exploring career alternatives. We saw the need to create a space, and this is by no means the only one, in which medievalists within and beyond the academy could still engage and create content on topics that they are passionate about. Whatever else it may be, this podcast is an invitation for intellectuals from all walks of life and at whatever point in their career to further explore and share their research and their thoughts on the medieval period and its afterlife. That is how this podcast, in my opinion, remains faithful to the spirit in which it was first conceived in those bygone days when Logan, Reed, and I were part of the GSC together.
And I have definitely found that true for me. After I graduated, I took a job not in the academic world, and this has been my main connection to medieval studies, my only, I suppose, connection to medieval studies after graduating. And it's been wonderful. It's been a fantastic way for me to still scratch that itch in that part of my brain, keep up to date with people who are doing all of this really interesting research. So it's definitely been the case for me, just working on the podcast, that it's been that lifeline, and I hope that it is for listeners as well.
Yeah, this podcast definitely helps me get outside my field a bit and just get to meet a lot of really cool people, either that we interview or help produce their episodes of. And that's been really fun. But I want to circle back to talking about the lore of this podcast a little bit, because classic John will be like, yes, it's horizontal. Everyone has been working together, which is all actually very true.
Very classic John.
However, it would be a disservice to not say that this podcast was really the brainchild of John, who was like, we could do a podcast. And us who were on the committee at the time just going, yeah, we could. And then we were all like, what if we did? And now we're on season 4, which is kind of surreal.
Reed, you're embarrassing me. However, I will say that even if the seed of the original idea was mine, Reed and Logan helped me water and make sure this tree grew up healthy. I would never have been able to get this off the ground on my own, and it has been exciting to see how we have continued to grow, something that was only possible thanks to our goodwill joining us early on, and now the magnificent Lauren.
We just recently had the centennial of the Academy. We had a Speculum Spotlight episode about this on the podcast where we were talking about the sense of history in the Academy and then the sense of the future of the Academy. And it's things like this where it's like, oh, somebody just had an idea that just lasts and then is carried out and continues on. And I just, you never know. You have to start somewhere for something to continue and to last then for 100 years. This coming year is the 25th anniversary of the Graduate Student Committee. So that's exciting. We were founded in 2001. November 11th, 2001 was officially when we were founded. And I know that because I tried to add that official founding to our social media accounts and then got locked out because I was seen as a minor for trying to create accounts that had too young of a birthday. But now that the GSC is 25, you know, we're allowed to rent a car and that sort of thing. But with that in mind, this is only like the fourth season of the podcast. But who knows, we might be celebrating the 25th before too long.
So this is a good transition to talking about the Medieval Academy itself, our sponsoring parent. And the MAA is celebrating a couple of milestones. We have its 100th anniversary. The Medieval Academy was established in 1925, so 2025, hard to believe it's already been 100 years, and we've been here for all 100 of them. And Speculum is looking ahead to its 100th anniversary next year, actually, in 2026.
And Speculum, for those of you who are just now tuning in, is the Journal of Medieval Studies that we actually have a partnership with that we call Speculum Spotlights, that every time there's a new issue of the journal, we highlight or spotlight an article or a group of authors who worked on something together with that issue.
And all of this really begs the question, since we're talking about the Medieval Academy, we're talking about the podcast's work with Speculum as well, where does our podcast sit in the history of the Medieval Academy of America and its work on medieval studies?
to get the conversation going, I think, you know, where does the podcast sit in the history of the MAA is really interesting because MAA is established, right? It's this organization for people within the United States to convene and work on medieval studies, right? And then it makes this journal, which then becomes this flagship journal for our fields. Now the Medieval Academy looks so different, right? There are way more women in it. There are way more people of color. The questions that get asked, what gets published is so different now. And I don't mean this in an arrogant way, like, oh my gosh, our podcast is so important. But I do think that we are another step in this opening up of medieval studies, where now it's not just engaging within that small sphere of academia and people who are medievalists talking only to other medievalists. We're trying to reach a broader audience. We want people who have an interest in fantasy or interest in the Middle Ages in any capacity to be able to find our podcast and maybe learn something, right? And have that fun fact that they can think about, or just have something where they can pause within their day and think more seriously about the past for a minute. So I think that's in some ways where we are within the Medieval Academy, is we're just part of this larger trend of opening up the field of medieval study.
Being a podcast, it literally brings in people's voices. We're bringing in more voices to be literally physically heard, and in a way that I think reaches a broader audience that sometimes a purely academic article wouldn't necessarily.
I think Reed and Lauren hit the nail on the head. As a public humanities project, we are making the knowledge we are producing available to someone who might just be passingly curious about the Middle Ages and wants to listen to an episode on their way to work, while exercising, etc. That being said, as I imagine the podcast in, say, 100 years, all the stock of centennials is getting to me, I hope that by then we will have adopted more collaborative models of thinking about what the Middle Ages were and their significance for the present and the future of humanity, and about how our ways of accessing the distant past are mediated. Also, as I think about the future, I realize that the podcast has several episodes discussing the problematic invocations of the medieval past, as well as episodes addressing some of the harsh realities that many medieval subjects experienced. I think it is important that we acknowledge these facts, but I also think that there is room for hope. There is room for growing and thinking more positively about and with a very diverse period in human history.
We can see that hope play out in the diversity of episodes that we have coming up in season 4. We want to dive into talking about some of those.
Something I'm pretty excited about is an episode that I finished helping the episode author, Aaron Patti, record recently about the role of ministerialis in the Holy Roman Empire. And it was fascinating because there are these administrative officials who were non-noble, but in a few instances over generations, rose from a place of non-nobility into a place of nobility. And in a lot of cases, they exerted quite a bit of control over the shape of society while they were themselves non-nobles, because things fell to them to implement a lot of the visions that were set out by nobility. And they got sometimes choice in how things were implemented. And I just thought it was really interesting. It was a thing that throughout my whole PhD, I hadn't encountered this. I didn't work with the Holy Roman Empire at all. So it was just a really interesting thing for me to learn about. I'm sure I come off as very unlettered on the episode, because all I can ever say is like, oh my God, that's fascinating. Tell me more. But that's how I felt. I just really wanted to learn more.
Couldn't come off unlettered if you tried. How dare you? Don't say things about my friend.
Thanks.
Well, I think one of the things that I'm most excited about with season 4 is that we actually have some returning contributors, which I just think is really fun, because you have people who were with us on season 1 and they've come back around with new projects. So specifically, I'm thinking of Larissa Grolemond, who is a curator at the J. Paul Getty Museum. She, along with Kellen Michael, have produced an episode for us about a show that the Getty did with the Morgan Library and Museum in New York about the Book of Marvels, which is an illuminated manuscript that was recently purchased by the Getty, and which there are several other iterations of in other collections, including at the Morgan. And so I'm just excited to see Larissa returning, but also, of course, to like have this be something that we're talking about, because it's an amazing object. And I really hope that people are marveled, you know, find this book as marvelous as I do. And so I think that'll be really fun.
So I've been hoping to shepherd in an episode, and I really had hardly any work to do in on this because she did just such a fabulous job right out of the gate. But Mary Catherine O'Connor is submitting an episode about the translation of French romances, essentially, in the Scandinavian context, in the Norse context. And as someone who works on Old French translation myself, I just really loved seeing someone bring out a translation project in this way. And she brought French literature into a context that I myself am very unfamiliar with. I don't work on Norse literature. So it was a really great crossover that I think a lot of people are going to really enjoy. And I actually brought up the episode in conversation the other day, and I even just mentioned the author's name, Mary O'Connor, to somebody said, Mary O'Connor submitting an episode? So it was just nice that I feel like we live in this sort of somewhat small but very connected world of people in the field of medieval studies. We just are so excited to see each other's work come out and in this format. It just makes it even better and, I don't know, fresh and more exciting.
I'm so excited for that episode.
Yeah, I suppose for me, one of the episodes that I'm most excited about is Emi Higashiyama's episode on surnames. I'm really intrigued by this. So at the time of recording, we're still working through the episode, the structure. So I'm really excited to see how it shapes out in the end. But she's talking about something which obviously we all encounter, operate within every day of our lives, which is how surnames function. And she's taking a very interesting approach, which is looking at surnames in several different cultural contexts, geographical contexts, one of which is in sort of the Northern European context. Specifically, she's looking at the Canterbury Tales and medieval England around 13th, 14th century, and the idea of occupation as something that defines your surname. Examples off the top of my head, things like Cooper, Carter, Cartwright, these kind of names, Thatcher, Taylor, and so on and so forth. And I'm so excited to see how it all comes together, because it's a topic which perhaps many people might not think of as a distinctly medieval subject, but actually a lot of these traditions in many different locations are being established, if you like, or set in stone in the medieval period. And then things continue to develop and change in different ways, different rates across the world. So I just think it's a great example of an episode which shows how the medieval world, even though we are separated from it by several centuries, continues to influence us every single day in the smallest ways, and in ways which ultimately continue to define our identities individually, as families, as groups.
Beautifully said, Will. As you were talking, I started thinking about the ways in which we draw out some form of meaning from the medieval past that helps us in some way in the present. I think it's important to know that the way in which we learn to think about our identity today has been a long process going back hundreds of years, especially with something as essential as our family names for our sense of self. I think it is important that we continue to excavate and interpret the medieval past in the process of imagining possible futures. And this is something that I felt was done quite well in the episode contributed by Michael Barbesat and Miles Pattenden about the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence and the Cult of Gay Relics. Miles and Michael look at the queer medievalisms of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence in the 1980s in San Francisco and in Sydney, Australia. Specifically, they discuss how the sisters drew on the intellectual traditions of medieval Christianity to repurpose the remnants of destroyed urban spaces as holy gay relics. I am so excited to share this episode with everyone.
I think this is something that I really enjoy about the podcast, Will, that you've brought up here, is that there are ways in which the medieval period manifests, as you said, in very small ways in our modern era. But what I also think is great for this podcast is that, especially like this season, I think we'll also be highlighting some things that are quite esoteric, even within medieval studies. So just to tease, we do have another episode coming out about medieval Bohemia and mural paintings, many of which have not even been studied by art historians of the Middle Ages.
I was going to say, Reed, thank you so much for bringing up the Bohemia episode, because if you didn't bring it up yourself, I was going to be like, tell them about the Bohemia episode. I can't wait to hear it.
Let the record show that Reed has mentioned the Bohemia episode in every single meeting.
I'm so thrilled about it. Like, I constantly am thinking about it. Genuinely, it blew my mind.
One of the coolest things about this podcast is the fact that I think we all get very excited about the episodes we work on. This is a passion project for us, as well as it is, I think, for all of the contributors of episodes. And this is an opportunity for us to transition into thinking about what goes into producing an episode for anybody who might be listening and interested in that. So Would anyone be interested in talking about what the process is of applying to the multicultural Middle Ages and what our roles as producers are in getting that episode to the listeners in the end?
Well, the first step, all listeners must follow us on Instagram and our Blue Sky account. Follow us there, and then you'll get the latest updates about when our new season proposals are due. So we're at Multicultural Middle Ages Podcast on most of those platforms, which, yes, is as long as it sounds. But, you know, MMA Podcast, turns out, has been taken by a lot of other differently oriented podcasts already. So
yeah. That's our other podcast where we actually arm wrestle and everything. It's really great. Will's really strong, but I can take him.
I'm not betting on myself in that fight. No.
Now, in terms of proposals, thinking about tips, so if you're listening to this episode, if you want to submit a proposal, and if you're really hoping to hear something that will help you kind of get it through the gauntlet and get it actually into the season, what do we look for in proposals? What makes a proposal a winner?
It's about art history. No, just kidding, kind of.
No, it's about French literature.
I think for me, what I look for in an episode proposal is that somebody does have a vision. Sure, they might not have the technical skills that they need to execute it, but they know what they want to say, or they have something that they're like, oh gosh, you know, people just need to know about this thing. And usually that passion is really infectious and it gets me excited about this thing that I didn't know about before, you know, I read the proposal. But I think having a structure is really helpful. Like, I want this to be an interview. I want this to be single dialogue. I want to splice in medieval music, whatever it is. You know,
and to build on that, I'd say that structure is essential, and for me, narrative, a clear narrative. I think effective communication often requires that you take the audience on a sort of journey, and knowing how you're going to begin your episode, whatever the structure might be, if you are interviewing experts, thinking critically about how those expert interviews would then build into the narrative you're trying to create, and then of course knowing how to land at the end and bring things together and wrap things up neatly. I think again it shows that you've really thought about it carefully and you have a vision for how you'd like this episode to appear, to sound.
All of that is great, but are there ways that people might be able to help us out without submitting episode proposals? Someone who might be sitting here listening, thinking, wow, love this podcast, love what they're doing, would like to help out, but I don't really have any research I'd like to platform. Is there a role for them to play?
My first thought was like, maybe you could recommend somebody else's work who you'd love to see featured on the podcast. I know that I certainly go to conferences and we'll see exciting work at conferences that I'd like to see appreciated more broadly. And so I don't know if that's taboo or cool, but I mean, I guess if you didn't have your own work to submit to us for an episode, you could reach out to people whose work you do know and love and encourage them to submit an episode.
And maybe be the interviewer.
And maybe be the interviewer. You could interview them.
Ask to do a collaboration. On the topic of feedback, we do have on our website an area where you can actually tell us what you think about the podcast. We accept notes of praise. We also accept notes of hate. Whatever you want to tell us. We are interested in making this kind of information accessible. And so if you do want to learn more about how podcasts are made through our collaboration with the Graduate Student Committee, we have created several YouTube videos which detail the process of both editing audio, but also things to keep in mind as you just develop an episode. And in fact, one of those videos features Logan, and he does an amazing job.
Well, we have been talking at length for a while, so I think if we want to move into the wrapping up stages, we have kind of an unwieldy final question to consider, and I'll leave it open for anybody who wants to answer it. It's about what the value is of medieval studies in 2025. It's about what medieval studies can offer us here in 2025 and beyond.
I'll take a stab at this one. As we go through life, all of us, we are constantly thinking about the past, be it our personal past, a communal past, or perhaps our past as a species. I think that our distance from the medieval past and the distant past more generally affords us an analytical edge. So when we look at the Middle Ages with a critical distance, we notice things that we can't immediately see when we think about events closer to home, like World War II, the Cold War, the AIDS crisis. There is too much unresolved in recent history. Many of us have family members that suffered through the Second Gulf War, for example. We recently emerged from a pandemic that took a toll on our social skills and our general well-being. So I think that in some respects, the stakes of thinking about the Middle Ages are lower and therefore simpler. So whether it is through the undergraduate humanities classroom in K-12 education or through more public-facing forums, there is value in raising the Middle Ages as a mirror of sorts.
Part of the value of studying medieval studies, and this has certainly been the case for me, is it really profoundly stretches your sense of time and your place in time. I mean, I know people specializing in all different time periods experience this, but studying the Middle Ages, a period of 1,000 years that was, you know, many hundreds of years ago at its latest point, essentially, it really stretches your sense of humans' existence on this earth. And I think it's really important that we complicate that narrative and think about how we reflect back on that. And John, you brought up K-12, and that just made me think of this silly anecdote, but I think it really pinpoints this succinctly for me. I used to teach high school French, and literally during one of my French lessons, I got a news notification that Notre Dame was on fire. So I turned on a live feed of Notre Dame on fire, and none of my students, these were high school students, most of them ninth graders, none of them had ever heard of Notre Dame, which I understand, forgivable. It's in another country. So these students, they had no idea what this building was or why anybody cared or what its significance was of its burning. And the only way I found that I was able to get them to think about the gravity of this fire was to recount the many, 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 many events and people who have passed through this building and this place. And I said that this building has withstood the Hundred Years' War, it withstood 2 world wars, it withstood all of these things. I talked about the beams in the ceiling and the trees that no longer exist and making it very material. Maybe read you'd like this, that it's a material object, but making it very material and then also tracing the many points in history that this one building has witnessed in some form or another and the many hundreds of thousands of people who have passed through it, then made them, I think, appreciate it much more. And then eventually one of my students said, "Man, Miss Lee, you really care about this a lot." I was like, yeah, and a lot of people do. I hope you will too. But anyway, I think that's it for me, is that it really helps you lengthen and complicate your sense of time and the passage of time. And I think it's really good to get yourself outside of yourself in that way, particularly for young students. I think they tend to think, you know, they've had such a short time on this earth that it's hard to pull yourself outside of your own experience. But studying the Middle Ages helps you do that.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And you're right. I do love that you bring in this material history, because I love thinking about how many hands have passed over an object, or whenever I look at a manuscript, I'm always like, I'm turning these pages. So many other people have turned these pages. But I think both what you and John have said has been really profound. And I actually want to reply in some ways with something that's quite simple, maybe. But I actually think that one of the values of studying the Middle Ages is the way it allows us to feel. So what I mean by that is that when you look at this past that is both similar and foreign from our own periods of time, I find it surprising how many emotions it can actually elicit, both emotions of pleasure, like when I look at a bespoke object that was handmade with gold and pigments that are still bright for some reason, you know, and ink that looks so rich, but it's all made by hand. You know, this elicits a lot of emotions within me, but they're not just all emotions of pleasure. I also have lots of emotions of horror, actually, about the Middle Ages. So whether that's thinking about, oh, parchment is made from animals, and I'm a vegetarian, and this makes me a little uncomfortable, or just all of the horrible atrocities that took place within the Middle Ages, all of the racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, these kinds of things too. But just being able to look at the past and still have this emotional connection to it, I think helps us process things within our own time period and feel things more deeply within our own time period. And I think that having emotions and feeling things deeply is really important. And so for me, this is one of the values of studying the Middle Ages or any historical period, really.
I totally agree with everything that's been said here. I think what I would add is that studying the Middle Ages, for me, gives a sense of perspective, which I think can be very sometimes grounding, sometimes comforting, sometimes, as Reed said, horrifying. But my own area of particular interest is medieval apocalypticism. And very often when I talk about this with people in the public, the response is quite often, well, that's certainly relevant. I suppose the implication being that, wow, it's great in the year 2025 that you're 24 or 23 every year that you're studying the end of the world, because it certainly feels like it. And it seems, from what I can tell and what from a lot of other scholars who work on this can tell, those same feelings have been felt by people for centuries, for hundreds and thousands of years. And it's certainly not to therefore diminish those feelings or to invalidate them or say that you're wrong to feel that way. Rather, it reminds me that humanity has met with crisis after crisis after crisis throughout our recorded history. And it can be helpful, I think, and maybe even healthy to remember that and to look back to how people handled it in the past and how they understood it and interpreted it. And maybe that can help us to reckon with our own contemporary apocalyptic feelings.
Listening to you, Will, two things pop out for me. One, you must be a hit at parties.
I don't know. I don't get invited to them very often.
Gee, I wonder why. The other thing that pops out is this sense that you and most of you have been talking about of time folding itself and how with time folding itself, how the human experience folds itself as well, right? And how we can find understanding and comfort in the past. I think that this alone already makes it worthwhile to continue to think about the distant past as it actually was, a time period of definitely imperfect people, but also it was a period of more diversity and understandings of identity than has been generally acknowledged. If we look for it, there is evidence of complex understandings of gender and sexuality, for instance, people who struggled with terrible loss, people that, much like us, wanted to find comfort as they tried to make sense of their existence. What do you think, Logan?
Something that I keep coming back to is how much artists or creators in our world keep coming back to the Middle Ages. I mean, we keep telling stories, not so much about the Middle Ages, but stories that use the Middle Ages or that use versions of the Middle Ages or that use tokens or icons of the Middle Ages. And those stories tend to be my favorite stories. But for me, it's really key that we understand the Middle Ages in order to understand those stories so we can understand what are we doing? Why are we going back to this? Why are we returning to this iconography? Why are we choosing certain parts of the Middle Ages to elevate in our cultural memory and letting other parts go? And that's going to be different depending on the adaptation or the piece of art you're working with. But I feel like we just keep making movies. We just keep making art. We just keep making fantasy that is medieval-esque. And in order to enjoy that and in order to continue to learn about ourselves via this art, we need to also learn about the Middle Ages that we're purporting maybe to represent or that are inspiring some of these things. But again, these aren't representations of the Middle Ages. They're representations of our society kind of cast through a medieval-ish light, which fascinating, interesting, love those types of media, but it helps with understanding them, I think. And that's a great opportunity to look ahead to the next four seasons, or to the next four seasons, to look. This is a great opportunity for us to look ahead and say, we hope that you enjoy everything to come in season four. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to find out more information about the podcast, about us as creators, or about any of the creators who will be featured in the upcoming season or who have been featured in past seasons, just go to our website at www.multiculturalmiddleages.com. And as Reed mentioned earlier in the episode, please follow us on our various social media channels. We platform not only our episodes and the scholars that we're helping produce their episodes, but we also platform other social media accounts that are doing really interesting and good research on the Middle Ages.